Welcome to the evening forum. I'm Jay Spoonheim, and I have the privilege of kind of both putting them together and the privilege of moderating these evening discussions. And tonight I'm especially delighted because one of the things I had hoped would happen when I came to Holden was that the forums would generate out of the guests, and the guests themselves would also be the resource people. And tonight's forum is a good example of just that. The issue tonight was suggested by the two resource people that are up here, Paul Hoffman and George Wright. Paul is a practicing attorney in Washington, state of Washington. George is an attorney currently doing graduate studies in Berkeley. And the two of them have suggested the issue for tonight, which is how can we approach the question of disarmament responsibly. Also, in keeping with the long-standing tradition of two nights, I think it's especially true that I've selected people of moderate statements, people given to... we have Paul, for example, noted for his restraint. His restraint in such terms as identifying those on the panel, those of us on the panel of the night, namely teachers, preachers, and church administrators as parasites on the... So as a especially, I had to get that in. He didn't know I was going to do that. But one of the joys of Holden for me has been meeting people. And Paul I met a couple of years ago up here, and that friendship formed quickly, and it's kind of a neat thing to be back together again. George, I just learned to know this week, and I know you're going to find both of them provocative and informative. The question, as I say, is how can we approach the question of disarmament responsibly? And George is going to make an opening statement framing the question for us.
Now, the key, I think, is responsibility. And the thing I'm trying to do in these beginning remarks is to suggest a situation in which we can responsibly act in dealing with the question of disarmament. So what I'm going to do is suggest an argument given by the economist John Kenneth Galbraith on how peace can be built in the world in our time. Let me first disclaim any expertise at all. I have no expertise in the slightest about disarmament. I'm talking just as a citizen and a person. I trained as a lawyer, so that means that I hope I can argue any point of view, any side, without blushing. That's really all I claim to be able to do. Let me point out that I'm not arguing my point of view. I'm not suggesting that this is the right point of view. I am suggesting that this was the point of view, and perhaps still is the point of view, that motivated Richard Nixon's policy of promoting trade with Russia and China, and probably still is a key idea in the Carter administration, although his moves on disarmament and Saul Thu suggest that he perhaps takes the issue more seriously, but perhaps not as well. The view I'm going to describe is probably best known as the convergence theory. It's kind of folk knowledge that it seems as if the two societies, the two superpowers, Russia and America, seem to be drawing together in some important ways. That is, that Russia, in order to stimulate its economy, seems to have moved, for example, in agriculture to a free enterprise kind of, or modified free enterprise, free market system. The complaint about American society is often that it's more and more socialized, more and more communistic, let's say, or at least more, tends more and more to be a welfare state. The theory, I guess, is two-pronged, and let me just read what I suggest it is. The first idea, the best hope for peace and relaxation of tension, what used to be called détente, lies in promoting development of those interests in the political and social life of the two great superpowers, that is, of America and of Russia. Those interests that can assure both the self-interests of each country and can lead to ever-increasing ties of cooperation and interdependence. It seems sort of straight out the right kind of thing one would say. The second prong is perhaps the key, that is, those interests that can promote our self-interest, and that can lead to cooperation with Russia. Those interests are primarily economic, and they find concrete expression in both countries in the increasing concentration of labor and capital in the large public and private industries, together with the bureaucracies that are necessary to run them. That is, that these interests are expressed in private industries such as the oil industry, the auto industry, the steel industry, and in public industries, for example, in the military, that is the army, in the welfare bureaucracy, and in government services in general. In short, that those interests that can lead both to something that helps us and that leads to greater ties of interdependence between us and the Russians lie in the area of what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex in both countries, that is, in the armies of executives and bureaucrats, in the Russian army, the American army, in Russian industry and American industry. The point of view then is that a stable peace can be built on the basis of the growing convergence of interests between American and Russian industry and military. That is, that the increasing mechanization, routinization, standardization, and to use a sociological term suggested by Max Weber, the rationalization of life in both countries is the road to peace. That's the argument. Now what I'm going to do is draw three implications and try to suggest the assumptions on which that argument rests. The first one I think is really sort of basic to the whole question of disarmament, and that is the assumption that countries don't do things that are counter to their own best interests. So the point of view assumes that we're not going to hurt ourselves, which I think is perhaps realistic and a good starting place, a realistic way of understanding the setting in which Christians, if they want to understand and suggest ways of disarming, have to deal with. That is, that disarmament must work for both countries. Okay, that's number one. Number two, the assumption is that peace is desired. That is, that the U.S. and Russia are willing to moderate and always increasingly renounce what each had considered its ideological mission. For the United States, that means that we will increasingly renounce our champion of democracy around the world, a good place in which, and for example, our championing of what we call human rights, perhaps. You remember that Kissinger talked about linkages. That would include perhaps a disinclination to involve ourselves in places like Vietnam. On the side of the Russians, it would be a renunciation to advance the cause of the oppressed working classes in tyrannies, in the bourgeois democracies, or in oligarchies. The post-war period, I think, found both countries set in the ideological point of view that each had a mission, each had something to say to the world, and largely what each of the countries was saying was antagonistic to one another. And the way in which we lived out that reality of each country having an ideological mission was the Cold War, in which it was very possible that what we stood for would lead us into a war. That is, that we actually felt that we had something to stand for and that it was worth fighting for. Now, I think some of the implications of such a view are clear. That is, the question, the diminishing of our capacity to articulate a national purpose beyond that of producing consumer goods or of advocating the goods society as opposed to the good society. And in both cases, the collectivization of both America and Russia in the interest of developing stabilities in each country that can be the basis for peace in the world. Now, the third thing I think is somewhat paradoxical. by promoting those interests of the military-industrial complex, that necessarily leads to arms buildup, because that, of course, is the way in which the military-industrial complex is beefed up in both countries. Now, what does that assume? It seems to me to assume that nuclear war is at this point unthinkable, that we have, in fact, that we have to deal with each other not in terms which actually take disarmament as a possibility. That is, that disarmament is in fact a cosmetic, that it is probably neither sought nor desired by either country, and that at best it's a kind of window dressing that perhaps expresses a feeling of mutuality, but that in fact doesn't go to the question of actually disarming ourselves, because that's not in fact what we want to do. To disarm ourselves would be to cut back on the military-industrial complex, and that goes counter to the point of view of the convergence theory. And I suggest that is the setting in which a responsible point of view on disarmament, well, at least has to start.
Thank you, George. I think maybe at this point we better allow for questions before we proceed with your statement, Paul, okay? Anybody want George to clarify or expand on or comment on any of the points he's made?
Sure. Do you have any kind of, is there any feeling in that theory about how far this expansion of can or will go, or is that sort of indefinite in that theory, or is that thought about at all?
Well, I think the theory suggests that we ought to expend our national energies and focus our national energies to increasing the sectors that build for stability in both countries.
Well, you mentioned that paradoxically increased the military-industrial complex and therefore increased the amount of arms and so on. I thought I heard that.
Right.
Is that just an indefinite progression in that theory?
It would seem to me to be.
Yeah.
I think that's consistent with what they call the mutual assured destruction theory, that is the MAD theory, that is the dominant one, that is that each population is hostage to the other population.
There is no arms limitation in that theory, period.
Doesn't seem to me to be.
Okay.
Other comments or questions? Paul?
I think if you are you're picking up on the so-called divergence-convergence debate, which is a sort of, as I understand it, a rather technical ideological debate that goes by those words. But one is, and that the official doctrine of the Eastern Bloc countries is divergence. The word convergence in Eastern Europe is a very bad word, and one not to be used in ideological talk. I'm just throwing that out as a comment.
Well, I don't quite pick up on your comment. Are you saying that isn't what Galbraith is saying? Or?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. I may have missed the first part of what you said. I'm just saying that the official Soviet doctrine is called divergence, divergence, they call it. And, it just makes me think that it sounds very good what you're saying.
It seems to me that that's the only way in which we can understand the policy of détente, the policy way whereby we encourage our American industries to send the Russians all our technology, and in return they take it. And it doesn't make a lot of sense unless that is the idea, that is that economic bonds are the bonds whereby we can build for peace. And I think that does suggest that an increasing inability to think of ourselves as the champion of democracy, as the cold warrior, as the hero of the oppressed peoples in East Europe, or the oppressed peoples under the communist boot in the Eastern Bloc, and of course the Helsinki Treaty, I think, is a good explanation, a good example of that policy in action.
what I'm saying, maybe my question is to you whether you think that this type of convergence at that level in any way compromises or would compromise the ultimate debate between, say, social, Marxist socialism and Western bourgeois democracy. That is,
well, I think this
do you
is
think that they are willing to give up that? Let's see, look at them.
Okay.
Are they willing to give up that?
Okay, let's say that this is what we're going on. Now, let's say, let's find out if we can really say that that's what they're going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have they, in fact, now I said that, that it rests on the, or that one has to say that we will moderate our championing of democracy. Does it also mean that they will modify their championing of the rights of oppressed minorities? It didn't seem to mean that in Angola, for example. They don't seem to have disciplined themselves. That is, they're not, their actions don't suggest that, that this is their point of view, or that, that this is the theory they're going on. Although it seems to be the only way in which they could have gotten what they got in Helsinki, that is, our ratification of their dominance over the Eastern European countries.
Any other questions or comments to George?
Are you, George, suggesting that we are being led down some kind of a path?
No.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting that. I haven't suggested anything yet. I've only described.
We
further comments?
Well.
Let me turn it to Paul then and let him make his opening statement.
Well, my approach, George and I, needless to say, have not compared notes, nor do we have we even discussed this. My approach, in fact, the issue has been reframed since we did it last night. So, just a comment on the community of interest that that George seems to indicate exists, perhaps east to west now. We've been accustomed so long to the east-west conflict. Those are the lines of defense. I was impressed by what Paul Wee said in his African discussion, I think it was in yours, concerning the developed world as contrasted with the undeveloped world, and perhaps we're missing the boat entirely. Perhaps the real threat to us in the Northern Hemisphere, most of the developed world is in the Northern Hemisphere, is the real conflict is North-South, and that we're pouring money down a rat hole in maintaining the defense posture we maintain when that threat is nominal or becoming non-existent. Secondly, on the issue of responsibility, I assume, Jay, that we were going to talk about not responsibility in a secular and loose sense, but responsibility in a Christian sense. And I think the awesomeness, the emergent nature of this debate centers around our Christianity and how we develop this issue in terms of our Christianity. I think we have to contrast the Sermon on the Mount in terms of, and getting down to very simple basics, the turning your other cheek and loving your enemies, and we have to contrast that with the things that we've grown used to since the quality of warfare changed in 1945. And those things that we've grown used to and we accept kind of cavalierly are massive retaliation and first strike capability, and now the worst of all, the acronym MAD, so well named, mutually assured destruction. How does all that fit in? There was reference made, and I think it's really appropriate this week that with the Yoder discussion, with the fact that we've been discussing suffering today at great length, exhaustively, in terms of the Holocaust, it's very appropriate that we discuss this issue. I can't disclaim expertise because I've had a crash course in the last 48 hours or thereabouts using Roland H. Bainton's book, Christian Attitudes Toward War and Peace. It's from this library, and it makes an instant expert out of anyone who reads it. It is what I think to be an excellent overview, a survey and critical evaluation of the problem. And needless to say, I think you'll, it'll be evident from what you hear from me that I agree with Baton. Baton comes down on the side of pacifism. He says that that's the only way he can resolve the issue. We had reference made this afternoon to Niebuhr and how Reinhold Niebuhr made a distinction. I think it was brought out that he was assisting. Who is he? The German
Bonhoeffer.
Yes, in the problem, the struggle that he had, assisting him in trying to draw a distinction between the individual Christian ethic and the collectivized ethic, that which is impressed upon the state. I have heard that, read that analysis in Baton, and I agree with Baton that distinction is a distinction without a difference. Let me just to frame the question a little and perhaps invite more discussion. Baton quotes with favor George Kennan. George Kennan was an ambassador to Russia in what, the 60s? He was in that period, I think. He's also written extensively. Let me just give you this quote and then I'll stop for the time being. In taking responsibility for the bombing of Dresden and Hamburg, to say nothing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, Americans went beyond what it seems to me the dictates of Christian conscience should have allowed. I regret as an American and as a Christian that these things were done. I think it should be our aim to do nothing of the sort in any future military encounter. If we must defend our homes, let us defend them as well as we can in the direct sense. But let us have no part in making millions of women and children and non-combatants hostages for the behavior of their own governments. It will be said to me, this means defeat. To this I can only reply, I am skeptical of the meaning of victory and defeat in their relation to modern war between great countries. To my mind, the defeat is war itself. In any case, it seems to me there are times when we have no choice but to follow the dictates of our conscience, to throw ourselves on God's mercy, and not to ask too many questions. He incidentally comes down on the side of, and this is horrible, this is a no-no, but he comes down on the side of unilateral disarmament, and he makes quite a case for it. ABC just ran a special. Those of you who have been up here perhaps haven't seen it or heard about it, in connection with the SALT talks, where we are today in terms of the capacity to kill, the enormity of that capacity today. With those weapons leveled at us presently, the button being pushed, approximately 140 million Americans die. That's the inevitable result, 140 out of our 220, and approximately the same number on the other side. That may encourage some discussion.
You base your premise on the mutual sharing of mutual destruction. In other words, that all parties involved assume that there will be mutual destruction in a major nuclear conflict. Is that your premise?
Is that my premise? I think history's taught us that the weapons we have, we use. And I think that's true, yes. I don't think it's necessarily going to happen in each instance. We may have a limited war in which these things are irrelevant.
No, but if there were to be a full-scale nuclear war, you're holding mutual destruction of both superpowers, say, Russia and America. Because you quoted the figure, 140 million Americans who die in a relatively the same figure in Russia, and that sort of runs against what I've studied. It's about half that in the Soviet Union.
So it's acceptable then at 70 million?
No. Another thing that is also interesting is if there is the thought of mutual destruction on the Soviet side, is the increasing of their civil defense. Their great program, which they've developed, which we dropped our civil defense program, really, and they're escalating that, and you know, I can see mutual destruction, but I'm wondering if that's
being viewed by all parties involved.
Well, that's the problem. They seem to have been putting up a defense perimeter around Moscow, for example, which suggests that they don't go along with the MAD theory. That is, that they're going to try to isolate certain spots in their own country from our bombs, which isn't playing by the game.
Did Baden give any clues as to how we could go about unilateral disarmament?
Well, in the same context, I think, as Yoder, there are risks. We may be vanquished, but the alternative is worse, and it isn't faithful. That's, I think, in a... He quotes, his last passage, I think, is really worth reading. It really sums up the entire book in terms of where we are. Can I just read this very briefly, Jay? Once again, the realists tell us that if we renounce power, we shall be at a disadvantage. Of course we will. When were the scrupulous not at a disadvantage in dealing with the unscrupulous? Shall the scrupulous then become unscrupulous in order to survive? Are we to renounce honor, shame, mercy, and compassion in order to live? The ancient pagans would not have said so. Did not Socrates declare that to suffer injustice is better than to inflict it? Shall we allow this pagan to take over the virtues which we have been wont to call Christian, while we invoke Christ to justify nuclear annihilation? That sounds like the discussion of Yoder this afternoon and yesterday to me.
Well, if it were just for ourselves, perhaps one could say that. Of course, if we were to do that, it would mean lots of jobs that folks wouldn't have. But it would also mean abdicating the role of the role that we had thought we had, that is, a championing of democracy and of people's liberties around the world, not only in Western Europe, but in South America and other places as well.
He discusses that at some length, the risks that we run, and that these perhaps are even selfish risks, because obviously the West Germans, for instance, will take it a lot sooner than we will. Yes, he discusses that and addresses it.
So is he saying we are responsible for the rest of the world's security position if we have a unilateral disarmament?
Can you hear all right? You're speaking softly,
yeah,
because it's so close.
In a unilateral disarmament that he's speaking of, aren't we not responsible for the various allies we have as far as security, or is that just their touch?
I suppose he weighs that against the risks that we run for our allies, our friends, by continuing this escalation. It's a balancing act that he's he thinks the risk is greater.
Well, but what do you think of the argument that 30 years have taught us that in fact we can live with nuclear weapons and not destroy one another, and even have nice and even have limited wars where we want them?
That's just luck so far.
Yeah. Well, okay, but I think the theory rests on the sense that nuclear war is in the best interests of no one, no longer the United States with it or Russia, and that in fact it's at this point unthinkable, that there's simply no way in which these two countries would push the button.
How about if the oil situation worsens? You don't think that there's a real possibility of a small-scale situation in the Middle East for control of Middle East oil, that on our fears, the way our population is reacting now, does gas gets up to $1 a gallon? Look at people that are
gas lines.
Don't you think our politicians are elected? They've already talked about creation of a special strike force to get control of Middle East oil. Don't you think there's a real possibility that a conflict occurs there?
I mean, between Russia and America?
One step away.
I mean, between Russia and America?
Mm-hmm.
But then that argues against the convergence theory, doesn't it? Because it says that Russia, in fact, is still our potential enemy.
Well, George, is It is George, isn't it? I'm sorry. I came in late. Paul J. George, it sounds like some composer.
Man from Concordia.
What I know about nuclear armament, I admit publicly, is not a great deal, but it seems to me that the whole stance of nuclear armament and philosophy has changed radically in the last few years. And there was a time, I suppose, when that was true, the deterrent aspect. I mean, we both have the capability of killing ourselves, you know, what, 50 times for America and 30 times for Russia. And there was this this balancing. And but now we have this emphasis on first strike. And the Trident, I think, is an example of that. And the Trident is able to pinpoint within 10 feet, I understand. And the whole design and emphasis of the Trident missile is to be fired and come down and take out all of their first line of defense. And so Russia, too, I think, is moving in this direction. So what we have is now two mighty nations with first strike capability, and you can see the hair trigger kind of aspect. And then you throw into that the knowledge that a lot of lesser countries now have the atomic bomb. It's no big thing to own the atomic bomb anymore. We've discovered that any intelligent college student can put one together. And you have countries like Pakistan and India, both of whom have been enemies, as we know, and both of whom now have the atomic bomb. What would happen if they got into a conflict and that drew in, as we just heard, other countries and eventually the mighty powers of Russia and America, who have first strike capability and are posed anyway and just ready to pounce on each other? I think that the whole situation has completely changed, and there's no longer a deterrent because we have the nuclear power.
I think we're going to go by hands now. The questions are beginning to generate, and there's been a hand up back here for some time.
I'm glad we're moving back into the realm where, away from people like Baton. Fine as a church historian as he is, I don't think he's an authority on this. It's really fair to deal with our own opinions. On the mutual assured destruction point, I'm wondering if we're saying that if it should be like George is saying, that the Soviets are trying to isolate certain population centers so that they'll be less likely to endure a devastating strike from that first strike. Are we saying that if they can reduce that threat so much that they're then likely to launch that first strike and take their chances? I think not. And you mentioned about the fact we've endured for 34 years now without a conflict. I find reason for some minimal amount of hope in that. Not a great deal, but some amount. In that only the several minimal times we've come close to using nuclear weapons, we were able to diplomatically work around the problem.
Well, I think that's the basis on which the convergence theory works, and I think that's the basis on which Nixon's policy works. And I think that that you're right, that we're no longer talking about deterrence because we no longer think that nuclear war is going to happen between Russia and America. The theory is based on the idea that nuclear war is unthinkable.
Well,
and that's why it's safe to allow the growth of the industrial complex.
Just to carry it finished, I think that what was pointed out earlier, though, about the oil situation is important. We need to be asking, what are those causes that are going to bring us to the point of wanting to use the weapons we have? And I think we ought to focus some attention on that, because it seems to me it's neither side can reduce that threat so much that we're likely to launch the first strike and take our chances. That to me, like you say, doesn't quite square. But we need to focus on what are the causes that might propel that, and what can we do about it?
So we want to respond to that?
But I something along the same line,
okay.
Or at least it gets in the realm of that. So we might not enter into a nuclear type of a war. But what about something that's potentially more threatening, namely economic warfare And the paradigm has already been developed for that, and it's called OPEC cartel. And several other cartels, you know, they put the potential long run destruction is great, is just as great in these types of warfare. So something I think Paul sort of brought it out too initially in our discussion. The North-South alignment, the carteling type of arrangements that are cropping up here. We've had a bauxite cartel that has attempted to crop up. We've had a coffee cartel. We've had the oil cartel. There are three or four others that I can't think about now. But those are as threatening in the long run, as far as I'm concerned, as the atomic.
Well, I think that's a peculiar strength of this theory. That is, it seems to be a rather far-sighted theory, in that it suggests that Russia and America have essential common interests, and that they mostly define themselves in opposition. They have common interests as technological, highly industrialized countries, and that's the way in which they can come together. And they come together, as they come together, they come together as defined against countries that are not highly technological, that are not highly industrialized, that is, countries that have natural resources. And so the theory seems to work quite ingeniously to suggest a way in which Russia and America can come together in this as great consuming nations, as great producing nations, highly collectivized, efficient producing nations, and continue to dominate the world, continue to have a lot of its resources, and somehow miraculously come up okay after the threat of OPEC, the threat of the coffee cartel, etc., etc. And so there may be this more interesting dialectic now between the haves and the have-nots. But I think it does pose larger questions. I mean, is that the way we want to view our society? Is that what we in fact want to be, the goods society as opposed to the good society? And perhaps then the question is, and what is the response of the Christian to this, to what seems to be happening? The increasing collectivization of American life, the increasing standardization of everything, so that all along all the highways in America you can see the golden arches, so that life is standardized everywhere we go, and we're pretty much the same wherever we are. Cultural differences washed out, local differences largely meaningless. I think that those are trends which are not only self-generating, but are in fact promoted and furthered by such a theory, and by social scientists. I mean, this is the staple of the social scientist. This is the view of the economist, of the sociologist, of the political scientist. This is their country. This is the way they want to see the country going. I think a real keen way to pick up on it is this, with this term rationalization. It's a term coined by the German sociologist Max Weber, what he saw happening in Germany in the 20s. I think that there are real ways in which this is happening in America. The routinization of labor, for example, the division of labor into ever smaller, more manipulable units. The laborer turns a screw and tightens a bolt. His labor is largely meaningless to him because he doesn't see the larger product, doesn't see what his labor is going towards. There's certainly a cost, I think, a human cost involved in that kind of rationalized society.
Who do you suggest is the operator in this society that's possibly emerging?
How do you mean the operator?
Well,
I mean, who benefits? It seems to me corporations benefit, the army benefits, bureaucracies benefit, both public and private.
Where in this scheme does your knowledge of the potential, you're talking about different cartels, the world domination financial cartel, which OPEC and all these other big industries eventually are pointing to? In the late 1930s, there was a book written, and they used the dollar bill and the pyramid with the eye on it as the symbol for one single financial world-dominating body. And where, in your mentioning Russia and the United States only,
and the potential for a large population to consume these industrial goods. You did not mention China. All right? Again, he asked who is going to police this. According to this...
I thought he asked who's going to benefit from it.
Yeah, who's going to benefit from it. So I believe it's this large, far down the road type, world-dominated financial institution. And that with China and the potential for industrial capacity and consumption there, where do we stand? What, how would this fit in with this disarmament or Poland? I'm opposed to more nuclear myself. I mean, how many times can you annihilate the world? But who's pulling these strings? Who's making the money off of oil? Who's controlling the timber? Who's controlling the coal? And it was written by, I believe, Supreme Court Justice Hughes about 6 or 8 months ago. He came out with an article. And he mentioned all the top industrial interests in the United States as having met with these OPEC nations. And he also mentioned the United States political entity. And he mentioned President Carter by name in this article. And he said, they're all in on it. And this, I got a very bitter taste in my mouth as far as disarmament and the OPEC so-called cutting back and all the peace efforts that the politic, and unfortunately I work for, but the politic entity is feeding the United States citizens, and I think it's a bunch of garbage. I think it's controlled by one thing, and that is the dollar bill. What do you think about it?
Oh, I don't know. Sounds right.
but that presupposes, you see, that there is going to be no nation state power. You know, that, you know, whatever we call patriotism and whatever we call nationality and all of that, you're sort of saying that that's already wiped out?
That's what the book written in the late...
Yeah, but that's just one of the possibilities of the models. Another one would be that the nation states may... that the nation state maintains the same power that it does and learns how to control the multinational corporation or that giant international monetary fund as you're...
That would be beautiful if we could, but we can't do it with one political entity in our own country as citizens of one country alone. When that power is funneled up higher and further away from the labor or peons, whatever, it's going to be just that much harder to reach the top of a bigger pyramid.
Sure, the organs are in place, it seems, for right. Transnational authority.
Right. I don't know what to do about it. Thank God that there is a God.
Hand way in the back, I see.
Yeah, I'd like to put a little historical perspective on things. Most people seem to have the misconception that we have the nuclear capabilities, but we never really have considered using them. And in fact, I think it's 13 times in the past when we've given, the United States has given definite consideration. Sometimes going as far to setting the preliminary, going through the preliminary stages. Some examples, Vietnam, the Cuban Missile Crisis, I can go on. The United States came out of World War II is probably the main power in the world. And it's that feeling of trying to maintain that power that has escalated the arms race, because I don't think it was ever Russia's intent to try and better us or whatever. And if you look at the developments in armaments, all except one, I think, and really new developments have been by the United States first and causing Russia to then counter in some way. And I'd like to maybe talk about that for a while.
Anybody like to speak to that?
Yeah, I've got some information on that.
A little louder, please.
I've got some information on that. Up until about 65, we had such a, you know, he said that 34 years, Brad mentioned, we had been living in without nuclear war. Well, there's no accident for that.
Is there any place in your theory for the possible change in faces that leaders of both nations there's some question about the Carter's extension in office, and certainly there's a lot of talk about Brezhnev's role and health. What happens if we got two new faces in another 2 years? Do personalities of the leaders have any role in this issue at all? That could change the whole ballgame a lot?
Anybody care to respond to that?
Yeah. No.
Well, it depends on who we elect. If you elect me, you know, in 4 years, I think that could have a definite.
Have we not switched from 6 years in the future to 4 years in the future?
Well, I'm just saying, I'm only impressed with the radical change that came about. Who would ever guess Nixon would open the door to China? And suddenly there it was. And now we're talking about a whole new ballgame that people maybe would have thought of it as happened years and years and years. That's what I, you know, it's that history theory of who makes history, people make history, history makes people. I don't know. That's what I find it's hard to think in the long run anymore. Some of those changes
that
happened because of these people.
And of course, Nixon probably changed his mind because of history. Nixon seemed to fly back and forth between whoever was advising him at the time. It would have been entirely inconsistent for Nixon to approve FAST, Family Assistance Plan, but in 1972 he just about did it. He wouldn't have become disenchanted with Monahan, he would have. And that would have been a greater coup for liberals from a conservative. So there were, you know, there were people there. So I think Nixon sort of just kind of bounced around and did whatever everybody else told him.
In that same light of that question of world leadership, I read an editorial in some magazine, I don't know where it was, that said, was speaking to the question of the fact that there really aren't any prominent world leaders right now. And that the political leaders of most of the countries, England, France, Germany, Russia, China, are so engrossed with internal affairs that they really haven't got time and energy to get outside. And somebody said, then the editorial said, watch Pope John Paul II. Now, in response to your comment of relationships, does this have any bearing on where we might be going? Might it be a place where we can go?
You mean the Catholic Church?
the comment that the religious, John Paul is a religious leader. And indeed, maybe then, the place for the vacuum that exists now in leadership in the world can indeed be filled by the religious community.
You're not seeing a political capacity?
No. The politicians are all in business of making cups and stuff like that, coffee, and finding gasoline. And the real issues are the issues of personality and the issues of meaning in life you refer to. This anti-rationalization concept, which is something that the church indeed should deal with.
No, I think so.
And so you're saying then that there's a real vacuum here that the church can move into.
Well, I'm saying that people like Tillich tried to suggest ways in which religious life could be deepened and which understandings that are profoundly human can be understood in religious terms, and in which religion has always tried to do that.
Okay, Paul.
Following up this last comment and bringing this discussion down to the congregational level just for a moment, if that's possible. Although ideologically, I don't think there's any convergence really going on, or really can go on. And in fact, the other night during our discussion about socialism and capitalism, it's very hard to find anybody who was prepared to say a good word about capitalism. Maybe we have to ask ourselves the question, why do developing nations, Asia, Africa, Latin America, look more and more to the Eastern Bloc as an answer to their problems rather than to us. This is offensive. It flies in the face of our post-war and even our Puritan sense of being the nation set on a hill and the light of the world. And it's very difficult. We have to ask ourselves why, say, the Lutheran Church of Namibia would be very happy if tomorrow the Russians and the Cubans marched into their country. The bishops and the people, the pastors, were all waved banners. Why is it that in Nicaragua, it's only the Eastern Bloc countries really that support the Sandinistas against the oppressive government? One could go on from country to country. The fact that we undertook this very ill-advised war in Angola right after the collapse of Vietnam, based on this bankrupt Kissinger policy, not being concerned about the people, but stopping the Soviets in Africa, or because of some vast principle, which is based on the ideological conflict. We are not really concerned about the poor, the downtrodden, and the fact is that they look to another part of the world. I think for a congregation, there are two things. If one assumes that there is some virtue in the convergence theory. Let's say that. If there is some virtue in it, even though I say ideologically, I don't think that there is any real mixture. Nevertheless, I think it's the congregation's duty to ask the question, maybe about that Paul Tillich asked. He was a religious socialist. Karl Barth, a religious socialist all his life, and working with the miners in Switzerland, suddenly discovered that there has to be a greater equalization of the wealth of the earth and the wealth of that community. And so they formed the Kairos Circle and other groups that were concerned about bringing what you say, the religious dimension, into the historical existence. They call it religious socialism. And Rogat and Kutter and others, Burkhardt, in Europe. And I think, by the way, that this is the way Europe is going today, although Euro-communism is dead. So I think that the duty of a congregation to ask itself the question, some of which we've been asking this week, namely, is there a good critique of our system that we're willing to listen to and to change? I think that there are ways that we can change so that we can become more humane, that we can not be the ones who are always looked at as the ones ripping off the developing countries to support the luxurious style of life that we've gotten used to. I think there are changes we can make, even little changes, in the style of our life. If it's true that the church is to be not a reflection of the world, but a sign of the kingdom, then the church of the community has to be rather different and at odds. Even as someone said the other night, it's subversive within its system in the name of the kingdom. So I think that's one thing. The second thing is that when we sign this agreement, on European security and cooperation, we and these other nations. And what we gave away, of course, is the realization that these post-war boundaries, we've acknowledged them. We said, we accept these post-war boundaries. What we got in return for that was the place where convergence comes in, namely Basket 2 and Basket 3 of the Helsinki Agreement, where we can exchange technological things, scientific things, but especially Basket 3. And that is where we exchange people, where we go back and forth on family reunification, educational programs, exchange. I remember when Goldberg finished Belgrade follow-up on Helsinki, he turned to the churches and he said, now it is up to you, as churches, in this country of the United States, and in all these discussions, the churches were involved, to test the Helsinki agreements. You are the ones that must have the programs to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. You are the people that now must travel to the Soviet Union, make contact, make friends, develop programs, and I think a local congregation, or groups of congregation, can on both fronts work, if one assumes some virtue in the convergence.
It's 5 after 10. We have tried to maintain that limit for bringing to an official close the time. And one of the great delights that I discover always around this fireplace is people who bring special gifts, as we've all discovered tonight. One that I've discovered is Merrill. And I've asked her, just on the spur of the moment, to kind of sum up for us at this point. And we'll bring officially ourselves to a close with her summation, and then those who are interested can stay and we'll continue.
I'll try. Okay, a lot of the facts and information and input I've heard here tonight has brought an image to mind, and that image is the Holocaust, which was contemplated all day long in a seminar. I hear us largely ignoring the third world fact, the population figures, 4 billion people now, 6.3 by the year 2000. I agree and really picked up on what you said about the polarization now is the haves and the have-nots, and we probably will converge with the other haves. If we do not choose to live the cross, we will choose to live in self-interest, and that means that those who have economic power will get together to preserve it. And the very fact that we have these nuclear stockpiles chiefly owned by the haves makes the potential to use that against the have-nots in self-preservation seem very imminent and very possible. We have not questioned at all the ethics of spending all the money, nearly a half of our budget, the U.S. budget a year, on military spending when there is such stark need in the world in terms of hunger. Again, what we're doing is we're ignoring the third world problems, and we're kind of getting our focus on the East-West conflict, which, you know, maybe is passé. I see a real potential for continuing fear, as the man by the post there said. Look what the gas crisis has done. Look how we have reacted, Christians included, self-interest at heart and in foremost part, our ultimate concern. If the have-nots begin to rise, as they are in South America, as they are in Africa, if this occurs on a global basis more and more, how are we going to react? If we react in fear and if we become anxious and decide to react in self-preservation, it seems to me the possibility of a charismatic dictatorship on a worldwide scale, as this man has suggested, is eminently possible. I've read articles that the Bank of Manhattan and other world concerns and conglomerates undercover have discussed such things and are in their workings. That's all I know, very little. I think for the Christians it comes down to Jesus Christ and the cross, and we're going to have to interpret for ourselves what our ultimate concerns are and what we think the cross is. Is the cross Jesus' act of saving us from sin so we may live in heaven? Or does it have a social implication? Are we going to learn to die to ourselves? Are we going to voluntarily lose? People are going to die. Those are the facts, and no one argues with that anymore. Whether it be war or starvation, people will die. And I think that Christians' decisions now, maybe we can decide that we will do some of the dying, and maybe it won't have to happen in bloodbath.
Thank you, Ron. Concluding statements from our...
No.
The idea of unilateral disarmament is obviously a political fantasy. And obviously a political, and I'm sure everyone picked up on that. My feeling is that in the Soviet Union, there is less, assuming that the Soviet Union was inhabited with Christians, and I guess there are some, there would be much less responsibility than there is in this country, again in a Christian response, and I have to admire this group. You can get off the Christian hook about as well as any You can secularize, we can secularize so well on these, on this subject. To me, it's so much simpler. But it seems to me in a responsive democratic government, one where it theoretically responds to us, and if we want to be faithful to ourselves, and even though we're a remnant, even though we only are a tiny minority, that if we are going to be faithful in this responsive government, we can and should do something if we come down where I come down and where Baynton comes down. I didn't hear any discussion tonight about the Sermon on the Mount in terms of massive retaliation, killing people. I don't understand. Why isn't that a critically important issue to a bunch of Lutherans? He points out that 20,000 Lutheran pastors were polled in 1934 between the wars. Would you favor discontinuing ever fighting a war again? The Lutheran pastors, Protestant pastors, who came in first by saying yes? The high on the high were, of course, the Brethren, the Mennonites, the Congregationalists were up there, and the Methodists, the Presbyterians. Down at the very bottom of the poll were the Lutherans. We're an aggressive bunch. That's it. Now see if you can leave. I want to thank everybody.